Thank you for allowing me to be here, for Diane and I to be able to come to this area and to work here. We're very delighted to be here. As Wayne mentioned, he and I and Phyllis go back a ways, sometimes so long we don't want to think about how long it's been. But I've certainly followed Wayne's work from the time in which we even were together in the Cincinnati area to his work in Columbia all through the time, and certainly encouraged by the work that he and Phyllis are doing here. So it's a real pleasure for us to be here. We're looking forward to the week, to getting to spend some time with Wayne and Phyllis and to get to know many of you that we've never met before and new friends. And I heard a whole lot of names as I shook hands this morning, and I apologize that I probably don't I remember Wayne, but the rest of you I probably won't remember, and I apologize for that. So just keep telling me your name, and maybe by the time I leave, I'll know the name with the face. We're going to begin in Hebrews chapter 10. I'll read a few verses here together. This is sort of a preface in some ways to some of the things we're going to talk about. At least textually it is, because we're going to be a great deal in Hebrews chapter 11 through the week, the Lord willing. And so these passages in Hebrews chapter 10 precede that, and I think set the stage for that. But if you read me with Hebrews chapter 10, verse 32, "But recall the former days in which after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with suffering, partly while you were made a spectacle, both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you became companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you have a better and an enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward." I want to make an observation here to sort of introduce the points I'd like to make this morning. Is it possible that the Lord's Church has really, especially in this country, is that the Lord's Church has suffered some from the long-term effects of its own success? In the sense that, is it possible that the dominance and somewhat the prosperity in American history of what we might call the Christian ethic has really produced some problems for us, or that has provided for us an obstacle sometimes in serving Christ? And let me explain what I mean. In the sense that if you think about American history, for most of the time that we can think about, believing in God, believing in the Bible, believing that even the Bible is the Word of God, and living by the principles of the Bible, has proven to be, for the large part, a good thing. It's been approved of by the larger part of our society. And to be a Christian and the common understanding of what that means has been accepted, not only as, in the most part, as being normal, but sometimes as being that which is beneficial to life, and even been associated in some regards to being patriotic. That sometimes we talk about this aspect that we live in a Christian nation. So being a Christian has generally, and in the sense of what that generally means in society today, has been accepted and has even sometimes been rewarded, sometimes even with material prosperity. And so to be a Christian, again, in this nominal sense of the way we think about that, meant that things were better. That if you became a Christian, that made things better for you. And I think we need to be really cognizant of that, and certainly we need to be thankful for it. It should constantly be a source of our true thanksgiving that we live in such a great place where living for God has not met a great deal of opposition. And there's some reasonableness to this in the sense that it makes sense that if you respect God's moral law and sexuality, then you're going to avoid a lot of even physical diseases and societal problems. Your family's going to work better. If you stay away from the dependency on alcohol or drugs, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to go better for your life, and we teach that to our own children. If you respect the other person around you, if you work hard with a good ethic, you're going to do better. People are going to reward that. And so there's a sense in which we put the principles of the Bible that we know from the Bible into our society, and they fit pretty well, and it makes things better. But there's a sense in which I believe that this acceptance and prosperity may have created somewhat of an unbiblical mindset among us, at least one that becomes sometimes an obstacle, and that is we have come to believe in many ways that, or we may assume that things should go better for us because we're Christians. That we've come to expect it. And because we've come to expect it, when it doesn't happen, then it causes a great deal of disruption. So what's the worst thing that can happen to us as Christians in our society? And I think some folks have come to the conclusion, at least we may assume the conclusion, that if we're not approved by the people around us, or if we get sick, or if there's this aspect of poverty, or things don't go well in our life, that's the worst thing that can happen to us. And it causes a great deal of problems for us. And that may even show to us in some ways that our appeal to help people become Christians, we got to reach out to people, that sometimes our appeal to those folks is that if you will become Christians, things will be better for you. And then things maybe are not that way. But at least that's the appeal sometimes that we almost subconsciously make to people. Our lives are better because we're Christians. Your lives will be better too if you'll become a Christian. One author stated that in today's society, the call to be a Christian is not a call to suffer as an alien, but a call to prosper as a citizen. Now, how does that match up? If we would assume that that's the way it is in our society, how does that match up with the mindset of the first century? What it meant to be a Christian back there? Well, if you remember in the passage we just read, that the writer says, the apostolic writer, calls on Christians to think back. He wants them to remember. And he says, remember the days after you were illuminated, verse 32. And then he reminds them of their great struggling with suffering. The term illuminated there points back to their conversion, the time in which they saw the light, so to speak, when they came to know the gospel and they obeyed the truth, they became Christians, just like it has been for us. And the text here then reinforces that when they became Christians, almost immediately they began to struggle with suffering. That their conversion was associated with the aspect of suffering. Now that fits well. Maybe not so much with us, but certainly it fits well with the history of the book of Acts. We go back to the book of Acts and we realize that in the first century, when the church first began in Judea, that there's a great conversions into Acts 2, but it doesn't take very long. In Acts chapter 3 and Acts chapter 4, the apostles are imprisoned. And then in Acts chapter 7, there's the stoning of Stephen. And there's the great persecution that comes through Saul of Tarsus in Acts chapter 8, so much so that the Christians are scattered abroad. And then you read on further, the book of Acts, and there's the execution of James, and Herod wanted to kill Peter in Acts chapter 12. And you think about what happened to those Christians immediately after they became Christians. How did that pan out for them, so to speak? Well, he described it here as a great struggle with suffering, and it was. Now, although it tells us later on in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 4, that the writer is addressing here had not personally yet suffered bloodshed for their faith, it's obvious that becoming a Christian in the first century, there was a price to pay. And so he talks about this great struggling with suffering. The original word for struggle here means to fight. It means to fight in the sense that you fight with someone to the point that you take blows, that you actually become hurt in it, you suffer pain. And that's what he's saying to them. As soon as they became Christians, the fight was on, and Satan was out to get them, and there was personal suffering that took place. And the apostle mentions two elements of their suffering, I think directly and indirectly. He says first that they were made a spectacle by reproaches and tribulations. The word for spectacle here is from the same root word we get the English word theater. You know, you go to theater to see something. And that's what the word literally points to. It was common among the Greeks and Romans in the first century and even before that when someone was condemned as a criminal, that before they were punished, they were led through the streets. They would be chained and led through the streets and brought out into the theater or the arena. People would gather around them and they would make fun of them and ridicule them, throw things at them or whatever. And so they became the recipients of the insults and the reproaches of the crowd. Now, there's no direct evidence that these Hebrew Christians suffered that, but that's the image that the apostle writes about here and uses to describe what they did go through. One translation says, sometimes you were publicly exposed to taunts and afflictions. You ever been there? Have you ever been reproached for your faith? Have you ever had a time when someone made fun of you or ridiculed you because you were Christian or because of what you believed or because what you held to be true? Have you ever known other Christians that were treated this way? People that were ridiculed for their faith? And that leads to the second thing he says here in an indirect way. He says, you became companions of those who were so treated. At one translation says, at other times you were the companions of those who were treated that way. So here's, you're not suffering it personally, but these folks over here are suffering it, and you know them. Maybe you worship with them, or you know they're Christians, and they're being treated poorly. They're being ridiculed for their faith. And he says, you became companions of them. Now, I believe that what he's expressing here is that they had a choice. It wasn't that they were just associated because they were fellow Christians, but rather that they made themselves companions of those who were being treated poorly. They had a choice. That they could have backed off. They could have said, well, I don't know those folks. Yeah, well, I know what's going on with them. They could have tried to be, you see, passive in all of this, but they didn't do that. They joined themselves or became companions of those who were being so treated. Now, that's not normal, is it? I think about, when I read through this, I thought about kids misbehaving. You know, I wasn't one of those, and neither were you. But there are kids sometimes that misbehave, and they're in a group, and they're doing something they shouldn't do, and an adult shows up. Maybe the parent shows up. And he goes over and he grabs his kid because he's going to make him stop, and he grabs his kid. What do the other kids do? They scatter, you know, because I know what he's going to get. I don't want to get what he's going to get. I'm out of here. Now, that's a choice you make, you see, when that kind of stuff happens. But that's not what these Christians did. They became companions of those who were so treated. And then he says, later on, he says, for you sympathize with the prisoners, or once the New King James says, for you had compassion on me in my chains. The King James Version, the New King James Version, translate this phrase as a personal reference to the author's imprisonment. What he seemed to be implying in those translations is that he became a prisoner, and then you came and you had compassion on me when I was in jail. And if Paul wrote the epistle, which many things people think that he did, then that fits Paul's, what we know about Paul's imprisonments. But the idea here is that the author went through something and they shared in him with it. The other translations present a more general description, which I favor in that regard. It says, for you sympathize with the prisoners, that there are other individuals, maybe these same individuals that you had become companions with, that eventually they were thrown in jail for what they believed. And so you had another choice. You had compassion on them. You had sympathy for them. That they were being charged as criminals, or maybe they were being treated like criminals. The word compassion here means to be touched with the feelings of another's pain. And sometimes it's easy for us when other people are going through suffering as a result of what other people think about them. In other words, they're being reproached in some way. For us to sort of back away from all of that, or to renounce them. To immediately switch over to the negative side. Say, well, yeah, I guess that's true. I guess he is that way. I guess he is really guilty of that. And therefore, to renounce them in that way. Paul commended Onesiphorus for his sympathy in 2 Timothy chapter 1. For the Lord grant mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chain. When he arrived in Rome, he sought me out zealously and found me. So Paul was in prison. Well, we've got to go see him, got to visit him. Onesiphorus sought him out. He wasn't ashamed of his chains. Now, these Christians, if this is what the proper description of what they're going through, certainly we're remembering the words of Jesus. I was in prison and you came to me. And as much as you did it unto one of these least of my brethren, you did it unto me, Matthew chapter 25. So they were there to support their brethren in that regard. Now, the reason I think that this, looking at this image for what it says in the text is important, is that we have to recognize that this is different than the way we've lived our lives in Christians for the most part. What did it cost them to make these choices that we just talked about? Well, I think when we think about this aspect of their own lives, we recognize that Paul's going to tell us here, and does tell us, that it cost them something. What did it cost them? Well, it cost them the plundering. Wait a minute, there's another point I wanted to make before I got to that. No, that's it. It cost them what the text describes as the plundering of their possessions. So they made these choices to be companions with those who reproached, to take on the ridicule personally, and to not be ashamed of people that were in jail. And how did the world that was reproaching Christians around them react to them? I believe what the writer's saying here is that somebody came and took away their stuff. You accepted the plundering of your possessions. It would seem to indicate to us that in whatever circumstance this was, that when Christians were mistreated, ultimately it came to the point where someone, the government or some other religious official or others, felt justified to come and take their property away from them. And that's what the text actually indicates. The word translated as plundering, or sometimes spoil, depicts the forceful taking of another's property. Now, whether or not they had the right to take that property, we would ponder that in our minds in our country. Didn't really matter. They still lost their stuff. And they knew going in that that's probably what was going to take place. So being a Christian in the first century did not mean things were going to go well, that things were going to get better. They were going to be plundered. They were going to lose their possessions. Now, the word plundered is interesting because the terminology itself indicates that one person has conquered another. That's what plundering is. Plundering isn't somebody coming in the middle of the night and stealing your stuff. It means they've taken your stuff as a result of conquering you. So one nation would conquer another nation, and they would plunder. To the victor goes the spoils. And so for the apostle to use that terminology to describe what was happening to Christians of the first century, when their stuff was taken as a result of personal persecution for their faith, is to indicate that this is the way it was viewed by the world in which they were around, that there was a victory. To be plundered was evidence that someone had conquered you, that you're the loser. You're the loser, so I'm taking your stuff. I have a right to take your stuff. So Christians in the first century were depicted by the society around them in the way that they were treated as losers. I'm taking your stuff away from you. That means I've conquered you. Now, were they really conquered? Well, we know that Jesus Christ gives us victory, and we are more than conquerors, he says. But what I want us to recognize here is that that's the image here. One person takes your stuff, he holds it up and says, see, I've conquered you. Again, I think about kids. Not because I did this, but we used to have a hill. Yes, I did. There used to be a hill in the back of a place where we grew up. We sort of grew up in the country. I don't know, somebody piled some dirt on top of one another. That was our hill. I have three brothers. And so when we had some kids in the neighborhood that liked to play as rough as we did, so we played King of the Hill. You ever played King of the Hill? You go up on top of the hill and you stand there and say, I got this. And sometimes we have a stick or we have some, this belongs to me, come and get it. And the job of the other kids was to run up the hill and do whatever they, throw something at, whatever they could do to take away that stick. But when they got the stick, they stood on the hill and they said, this is our stick and now we're King of the Hill. So you tried to be King of the Hill, and when you got King of the Hill, you held up what you'd won. You had plundered the other person. And you held up as evidence what you had, that you were the winner. So here Christians in the first century, and their physical property is being plundered. The world sees that as a victory. The writer is reminding the Christians of the first century, this is what happened to you after you became Christians. Do not forget this. Now he's going to make a point that's implicit in this as to why that's important for them to remember. But before we get that, let me ask you this, what would that look like today? We've talked about the fact that this is different than the way we grew up as Christians, or what society looks at us as Christians for the most part, has been anyway. What would it look like today? Sometimes we have find difficulty making application to this text in our personal lives. But there are a lot of people who are alive today as Christians who could immediately recognize what this text is describing, in the sense that they have risked everything to become a Christian. And they do it every day. They risk even their own lives to take the gospel message to a place where it's not the dominant acceptance of the culture, where Christianity and serving Christ is not what makes life better. It makes life dangerous and treacherous. And so they've taken the gospel to North Korea, to Pakistan, to Somalia, to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to Iran, to Sudan, to Syria, to Yemen, to Nigeria, to Libya, to China. All those places you see that are not here, where Christians have to stand up and risk everything to be counted as disciples of Jesus. And they do that every day. I would suggest to you they can relate to this text better than we can. And then there are those, even in our own society, who accept the biblical definition of marriage as the joining of a man and a woman, as the Bible describes it, and whose faith will not allow them to expand that definition beyond what the Bible says, just to accommodate society or just to accommodate the Supreme Court or some decision that's made. They recognize that this is what the Bible teaches. And so then they read 1 Corinthians 6:10 that says those who live without repentance and same-sex relationships cannot inherit the kingdom of God. They stand by that and say, well, that's what the truth is. But does it cost them anything? Well, in society past, there wasn't many opportunities for people to have to risk anything to hold that view. But we know that has changed. If you do not celebrate immorality in many ways of society, it will cost you. cost you your job. It'll cost you your bakery, your photography business. It'll cost you something else, you see. Because that's what it means. They will plunder your property. Those who stand up for the God-given roles in the home and in the church, who see that the Bible clearly defines gender and the different roles of gender in society, are reproached and ridiculed. Those who stand up for the sanctity of life and oppose the taking of life in the unborn children in a world, in our world. Many of them have been jailed and lost their jobs and certainly have had their reputations ruined. Christians who oppose racism and ethnic oppression in places where it is easily practiced and even rewarded are making a choice that may very well cost them, and many times does, cost them the plundering of their possessions. Someone's going to come along and take away what they own and what they've worked for and what they have. You're going to take it away from them and feel rightful in doing that simply because they stand up for what is right. So it seems clear to me as Christians that Americans today are moving closer and closer to having some solidarity with this text on this issue. There are more and more opportunities for us to experience reproach, ridicule, and even the plundering of our goods. We will have to make choices as to which way we will go on this. But when we think about this text as well, what did they do? How did they react to the fact that their property was taken away from them? Well, it says here, not only just that they accepted it, but notice there it says they joyfully accepted the plundering of their property. When do I need to quit? Okay, good. Audible reinforcement, I like that. The brethren at Southside like that too. They have a real loud one. But it says they joyfully accepted. Now we shouldn't overlook that. It's one thing to accept the plundering of your property. It's one thing to accept ridicule and reproach. Someone does to you, particularly if you can't do anything about it. What are you going to do about it? It's another thing, you see, to joyfully accept it. That when it comes, you're willing to rejoice and are able to rejoice over what has just happened. Jesus depicts the righteous suffering as a characteristic of a joyful, blessed life. He connects this aspect, you see, of happiness or blessedness, as he describes here, fulfillment in life with suffering. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely. So Jesus says that there is a connection between suffering and having a fulfilled, joyful life. Now, that connection is not obvious to us, is it? We think these people that are being, their homes are being raided or in every way they're being ridiculed and made fun of in society. How can that make you joyful about life? And yet there it is. There's that connection that Jesus makes. The Christians of the first century church were able to understand and make application of the connection that Jesus had taught them between righteous suffering and joyfulness. And I think the way that they did that, at least for what the text would describe to us, is that they were able to develop a perceptive connection between their suffering and Jesus' suffering. If you're a disciple of Jesus, your job is to mimic Jesus' life, to learn from him and to follow him. And you look at the life of Jesus, what do you see? Well, you don't see the prosperity gospel in action, I can tell you that. You see someone who stands up for what is right and suffers a great deal because of that, and whose suffering was not just to be viewed in the context of the result of his righteous living, but it was to produce righteous living in others. So it was the catalyst for which you and I could become righteous that Jesus suffered. And so that's what the first century Christians learned to understand. Is for this is commendable, Peter says, if because of conscience toward God one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it when if you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. So Peter says not only is it connected to the aspect of being able to be joyful about it, and that's certainly where it leads, but God's pleased with it as well. Colossians chapter 1, verse 24. If I have this one up here. Yes. I now rejoice in my sufferings for you and fill up in my flesh what is lacking in the afflictions of Christ for the sake of his body, which is the church. So the Christians were able to make this connection between their suffering and the suffering of Jesus. Fill up the suffering of Jesus and my own suffering on my life. In Romans chapter 5, he says, we rejoice in the hope and the glory of God. Not only so, but we also rejoice in our suffering because we know that suffering produces perseverance. And goes on from there. And what I want to notice about that passage is that Paul in Romans chapter 5 connects the very things we're looking at here in Hebrews chapter 10. And that is, we rejoice in hope and we rejoice in suffering. Two things we rejoice in. Is that connected? How do we recognize that the suffering, that we can rejoice in suffering and hope at the same time? I believe it's because we can rejoice in suffering as a result of the fact that we rejoice in hope. And so Paul connects these two things. And so how could they do this? How would this come about? Well, I believe it's because they were able to make a disconnection with the world in which they lived. How's it? As our culture changes and we are more exposed to this aspect of being plundered by sufferings and about persecution, how are we going to get ready for that? Folks, we need to get ready for that in our society. We do. How are we going to get ready for that? Well, I take a cue from this aspect of how the first century Christians dealt with this, how they were able to make these type of choices. And I think one thing that's central to this is that we have to truly get back to this idea of being detached from the world that we live in and detached from the possessions, the popularity of this world. We must refuse to not be conformed to this world, but rather be transformed by the renewing of our mind, Romans chapter 12. If we're going to be prepared for this plundering, then we have to deal with the covetousness and the materialism in our lives that would make this difficult for us. And so, Matthew chapter 6. Again, we go back to the teachings of Jesus. Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. I believe Jesus could have added to that, and where you could be plundered by it all being taken away. You put it there, someone takes it away, you're going to feel bad about it because you've got all that invested right there and they took it away from you. So the very idea of losing what we have being a problem for us is connected with how much we're attached to what we have. And we cannot break our attachment to this world without nurturing and developing a real satisfying hope in the world to come. So Paul says you can rejoice in your hope and you can rejoice in your suffering at the same time. Because as you nurture your appreciation for the hope that you have, then you'll be able, as you see, to rejoice even when these things are taken away. And so he says in verse 34 in the text, he says, knowing that you have a better and enduring possession. So he's getting them to remember back. How come you're able to do this? I'll suffer all through this and to do it joyfully, accepted it because you have an enduring, a better, a hope and a better and enduring possession for yourselves in heaven. You see, they plundered these possessions, but I have these and nobody can take these. They can take these, but they can't take these. And that's, I believe, a point that the writer is making here. It's interesting that some of the translations use the word substance here, that you have a better and enduring substance for yourselves. And that word substance, in the English language anyway, carries with it the aspect here of reality. You know, there's substance and there's the things that reflects, or the shadow that reflects the substance. What's real? What's real? Sometimes we have it reversed, don't we? We think about what's real, what's here, what we see, what we can touch. That's the substance. The shadow is what's to come that we can't see. But Paul says, no, what you have is that you have a real substance in that which has not yet appeared yet. Your faith and your hope is in the reality of heaven. That's the real thing. This here is going to all pass away. And so the aspect of you have a better and enduring substance for yourselves in heaven. And we can rejoice in suffering when we learn to rejoice in our hope. We cherish the reward that we have in heaven more than what we have here on earth. And that's what Paul addresses, you see, in Colossians chapter 3. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things of the earth, for you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. Your life is hidden. Hidden from who? Well, there are different ways of looking at that and what Paul's talking about. But one way to view this is that it's hidden in the sense that it cannot be touched. It cannot be taken or cannot be confiscated by anyone else because it is hidden in God. And so the apostle's intention in our text is to encourage these Christians to not give up. If you look at the whole general aspect of what the writer of Hebrews is attempting to do, it's to get these folks who've come out of Judaism to not go back to serving God under the law, but to remain with Christ because Christ is better. And so he talks about this aspect of, you see, Jesus is a better high priest. He has offered a better sacrifice. He is a better mediator. And we are under a new covenant. So he says, don't go back. So I find it fascinating that in that general aspect of his admonition here, that he would have them remember what they've already experienced. Remember what you've already gone through. How this all started. How'd it go for you when you first became Christians? What have you endured? He's going to tell them they're going to endure more. They have not yet suffered under bloodshed. But he doesn't want them to forget the fact that this whole experience has been an experience of suffering. And in a sense, he's telling them that's been good for them. That's provided a basis, a foundation from which they can face the future. And that's what worries me about myself, in some sense. I come from 5 generations of Christians. I grew up knowing what the Bible taught, being taught in class, all the stories that we're going to, even that we're going to talk about this week, and what the aspect of what it meant to be a child of God. And I grew up in that generational society, generational environment, in a society that for the most part rewarded people when they strove to do what was good. And all of that's changing before our eyes, is it not? That things are going to be different for Christians, I believe, in the years to come. And I wonder whether or not I'm really prepared for all of that, to make the choices that I may have to make, because this is what the apostle's saying to me. Do not forget, you have suffered, and I haven't suffered very much. Maybe you have, and many Christians have. We just mentioned a few of them. But what he would tell me is, do not give up. Do not give up. And so he says at the end of these verses, therefore do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. There's that hope, you see. For you have need of endurance so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. Faith is based upon the aspect of promise. We'll talk some about the Lord willing that. We'll talk a little bit about that this week, the Lord willing. But I believe it's so connected with the aspect of what it means to live out our faith that we remain cognizant of. And ever before us, this aspect that we're not staying here. We're going someplace else. Our treasure does not remain here. It's what God's going to promise us and has promised us for what is yet to come. And that provides for us the opportunity to have a totally different perspective on the life in which we live now. A very powerful one. Not a weak one, but a very powerful perspective in that we live for what is yet to come and what he can do to face the future. Fascinating passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Paul's here describing the life of an apostle, but I think the same aspect here applies to Christians in general in many ways. How do you view your life? Well, it's sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. It's poor, yet making many rich. It's living as having nothing, yet possessing all things. That's what the Christian life is about, isn't it? How can that be? Such a contradiction in terms. That you have nothing, but you have everything. That you're sorrowful, yet you're rejoicing. That you're poor, yet you're rich. Because of Jesus. That's the only way that's possible, because of Jesus. What he's done for us, what he's provided for us, and what he will give to us in the future is this promise that we can have joyfully accept all the plundering of our goods here, and we can rejoice. Thank you for your attention. This is a class period, and you've let me preach. I appreciate that. Questions or comments anybody would like to make? Anybody want to express anything? Yes, sir. Sure. That's exactly right. And you know, I think when I think about that, and just going off your remarks here, that I think about Satan didn't know what was coming. I mean, I don't know how much Satan knew, but he really thought he had it under control on Friday. But then the resurrection changed all of that. And you and I have already experienced the resurrection. We've been buried with Christ and raised to walk a new life. We are already possessing the victory in our lives, so we don't have to think of ourselves as losers. And I think sometimes Christians think that way in a sense that, in a subconscious way, well, I'm a loser now, but I'm going to win later on. Well, you're already a winner. Jesus already come out of the grave. Satan defeated, you know. And God, you know, Paul says he leads me in triumph with Christ. I'm already right behind him and sharing in the fruits of the victory. It's just, we haven't had experienced that in this. That's a good thought. Very good thought. Anybody else have? Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes we're not good at practical questions. And creating a better perspective is certainly one of those. I wonder if you have any thoughts about, I guess I wonder sometimes if we're so influenced by our culture that the way we handle disagreements, and don't look any farther than the news, we get combative.
Yes.
We want to fight. I wonder if one of those, how do we prepare, is maybe just learning how to not load up our spiritual shotgun.
That's exactly right.
And maybe it's more about me to train ourselves to just be a little bit more civil in how we present our perspective. That's something I think about.
I think it's a very good point. You see, Jesus in the garden, you know, he'd been trying to prepare his disciples for what was going to come. They didn't see it coming. They didn't know what was going to come. Jesus knew. So he tells them, watch here and pray. Stay, and they fell asleep. But he'd been preparing them the whole night before, and the conversation about, I will give you peace, put your trust in me, don't abandon each other, love one another. And then it comes, and they come to arrest Jesus in the garden. What's Peter do? He draws his sword, you see. That's the way we react. You're exactly right. That's the way we react. We're being confronted with something we've never been confronted before. Our first reaction is the normal reaction to fight back. So he draws a sword. Jesus put it away. You live by the sword, you're going to die by the sword. This is not the way we're going to deal with what's coming. And I think we have to take a lesson from that. And sometimes we're not very good at that. It doesn't mean we don't stand for the truth, that we don't teach the truth in the face of error. It certainly doesn't mean that we compromise anything. But submissiveness and treating the other person like I would want to be treated is the very heart of this preparation. That's a very good point. Anybody else have thoughts?
But our tendency, even in evangelizing people, may be to draw our spiritual sword.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And to use the Word of God to do combative work, if that's the way to say it. Yeah. We have to teach with meekness, you know. We have to teach truth and love. We have to teach those who are in error with meekness. And that's a difficult thing for us sometimes to develop. It really is.
I think it's difficult sometimes because sometimes Jesus spoke out with, with a lot of energy and harshly. And so here we are, to try to decide. And a lot of times maybe we decide to be harsh at the wrong time, the wrong things. But there is certainly a time to stand up.
That's absolutely.
And a time to be, to let it go.
And that discernment is again, something we need to learn from the Lord and learn how to do that, because Jesus did, particularly the hypocrisy of his day, those things that stood, that appeared to be righteous to others that were not righteous, Jesus exposed them without reservation. And you can't read Matthew 23 without recognizing Jesus was standing up in a very bold way, in that regard. But when it came to what they would do to Jesus, what the bad people would do to Jesus, he was always, as Peter says, he was always unreviling, and I think we have to learn that. Yeah, very good point. Any other thoughts? I hear a bell. Thank you very much for your time.